I'm an addict. My name's Biff. Hi, everybody. Well, after an introduction like that, I think I'll sit down. I really appreciate you having me up here. It's been real nice. Before I go any further, I really would like to thank the committee for asking me to be here, and I'd like to thank the people that have been here for me since I got here. This is one of the first times I really thought I was going to be coming to an area that I didn't know anybody. And I didn't know a lot of people, but I felt like I really knew a lot of them by the time I'd been here. You people have been really outgoing and real warm and made me feel really a part of, and I really want to thank you for that. Really appreciate it a lot. I don't want to talk too much about my using because I don't really know too much about it. You know, the longer I've been clean, the less accurate I realize my story about what it was like out there is. See, I was real grandiose when I got here, and so my story was really fabricated to make it a lot more romantic than it was. I was pretty boring out there. It doesn't mean that I didn't hurt myself and hurt everybody else I came in contact with. It means I didn't do it in a real flamboyant way. I didn't run and gun in the streets, and I didn't have a real romantic story, and I didn't do all kinds of real exciting things. At least I didn't feel real exciting. As a matter of fact, I didn't feel very much of anything. I do remember the feelings I did have, and I remember the feelings I had before I started to use, and I'd like to tell you that they went away while I was using, and that they've stayed away since I got clean, but that's not nearly true. The first feeling I remember was absolute fear, and even today I can't tell you what it was I was afraid of. Probably the hardest thing I had to deal with is any time I told anybody I was afraid, they wanted to know what it was I was afraid of, and when I couldn't tell them anything, they kept telling me there was nothing to be afraid of, and that only made me more afraid. And I learned very quickly not to share that fear with anybody because all it got me was in trouble, lots of different ways. I kept that fear stuffed for an awfully long time and realized that almost all of my behavior during my addiction, my active addiction, was an outgrowth of that fear. I was afraid to let people get to know me. I was afraid of being alone. I was afraid of being with people. I was afraid of being intimate, and I was afraid of being not intimate. It was a no-win situation from Jump Street, and I'd like to tell you that the drugs made the fear go away, but they didn't. If the drugs had made the fear go away, I wouldn't be here today. If the drugs worked for me, I wouldn't be here today. I took drugs to stop the pain, and I got here because the drugs stopped stopping the pain. You know, I didn't get here because I wanted to get clean. I didn't get here because my life was unmanageable. I got here because the drugs quit working. After I got here, I learned all those other things were also true. I remember doing a lot of devastation and a lot of pain to everybody around me the whole time I was using, and even before that. I didn't have to have a drug in my system to act out. All the drug did was help me act out without worrying about it. I used for a very long time, you know, and it was a real not characteristic using pattern from what I heard when I first got here. What that did for me was it made me lie when I first got here because, see, my whole life I feel like I didn't belong, and then I got here, and when I got here, if you didn't shoot IV drugs and if you didn't run and gun in the street, you didn't belong in Narcotics Anonymous because that's all they talked about. So I lied. It didn't take me long to learn how to lie about things I'd never done because that's all we talked about in the meetings in those days. We didn't talk about steps. We didn't talk about recovery. We talked about how bad it was out there and all the insane things we did. And it was the best we could do, and it kept us clean because I guess it scared us clean for a while. I told people that I used IV drugs. I told people, I talked about all these things I had done, that I was a hope-to-die dope fiend, about running and gunning in the streets, about having a spike in my arm and all that stuff. None of that was true. But I didn't hear what the literature said. You know, where it says we don't care what or how much you use. I guess I read it and I heard it, but I'm sure that that meant other people, not me. I still thought I was different. And I still thought that if you knew that I was just a drug addict and not a dope fiend, that you wouldn't want me in Narcotics Anonymous. And I was so afraid of not being wanted at that point that I was willing to go to any lengths to belong. When I finally got honest, I had about 2 years clean. And I told the people that I had been recovering with that that was true, and nobody seemed to even bat an eye. You know, I was so afraid of, oh, my God, I'm going to tell them I never shot dope, and they're going to Jimmy, all this stuff, nobody, they kind of understood. I had a feeling deep down inside they probably knew it all along and never bothered to call me on it. And it just let me know how little touch with reality I really had. Most of my fears are not bounded in anything but fear. I mean, they're not bounded in any reality whatsoever. The only reason I talk about not shooting dope is that I know for an awful long time people like me were afraid to say that they didn't do that. That doesn't mean that I didn't use enough to be here. It doesn't mean that I didn't have enough pain. It doesn't mean that I don't share the common bond of the disease of addiction. And it certainly doesn't mean I didn't earn my seat in this room. And if you're new, it's real important to know that we don't care what or how much you used. We all know what it feels like to use, and we all know what it feels like to want to stop and can't, and we all know what it feels like to be so afraid every day of our lives, and we all know what it feels like when we walk into that room and somebody puts our hand on your shoulder, looks you in the eye and says, "Welcome to Narcotics Anonymous, you never have to use again." I'd like to tell you that that's how it happened for me. You know, that I'd had enough of drugs, and I walked into a meeting, and somebody put their hand on my shoulder, and I found home. And I hear people that tell that story, and I'm really glad that that happens. I'm not really sad that it didn't happen for me, because I had to do what I had to do to get here. And I'm only glad that I'm here. I don't care what it took to get me here. But what it did take to get me here was a little bit different than some other people and probably real similar to others. I was the kind of addict that when I was out there using, people loved to use with me because if they ever got as bad as I was, they'd quit. You know? And so I always had people around who wanted to use with me because it made them feel healthier. You know? And I was the same way. I looked at other people and thought I wasn't as bad as they were. You know? I was also the kind of addict that never had to worry about having a drug of choice. You know? I was real lucky. You know, I did not have a drug of choice. I would use anything I could get my hands on. I didn't care where it took me as long as it took me away from where I was. You know, and that was real difficult for some people to understand. I used unsuccessfully through a few marriages and through a couple of geographic cures, and I used for 25 years. And I realize now today that that makes me very, very lucky because most people don't use for 25 years and get to survive. It doesn't make me unique because I know a lot of people use longer than I did. And I'm grateful for that, too. I got here because the wife that I was married to at that time cared enough to set up an intervention while she was on her way out the door. You know, and what she did was, I was a therapy junkie my last 2 years of using. I knew that there was something terribly wrong, but I couldn't accept the fact that it was anything like the drugs. So I went to therapy, and I went to therapy once a week on a private session, once a week on a joint session with my wife, once a week on a group, one marathon a month, four retreats a year, tra-la-la-la-la, you know. And what I did was I turned my will and my life over to the therapy group as I didn't understand it, and I got real mad because they couldn't make me any better. One thing did happen to me in therapy that was of some value. Well, two things. The first thing was is I got involved with this workshop. And this guy who was really, really a good therapist, as I've come to understand later, sat across from me and listened to all this babble that was coming out of my mouth and looked me straight in the eye and he said to me, "I can't help you." And I was really offended. I mean, he helped all these other people. What's wrong with me? And he said to me, "You're not neurotic. You're not psychotic. It's a matter of character. You just have to change." And I didn't understand what he was saying at the time. I kept saying to him, "I don't know how." And he said, "Just do it." And I said, "I don't know how." And he said, "The only way to change is to change." And I got real angry, and I got real resentful, and I felt really ripped off, and I carried that resentment for about a year or so, and then they did an intervention for me. And I didn't know what an intervention was at that time, but the therapy group did that deal, and they put me in treatment. And I have very strong opinions about most things, so I need to say that whatever I'm going to say is my opinion and certainly not the opinion of Narcotics Anonymous. And I have a real strong opinion about treatment, and I realize I'm in the treatment capital of the world, but oh well, you know. Treatment and recovery have nothing to do with each other in my life. Treatment for me was a nice place for me to catch my breath until I could learn something about recovery from this disease. And I'm not saying that people don't need treatment or people do need treatment. That's none of my business. I know for me, obviously, I needed treatment or I wouldn't have been there. But I didn't need treatment to recover. I needed treatment to stop the insanity long enough to realize I needed something else. Fortunately for me, that treatment center believed in 12 steps. They also sent me to a halfway house. It was a four-week treatment center that I got to stay in 8 weeks, and then they sent me to a halfway house for another 3 months. I had a little bit of denial going on there, and slight unmanageability. And the other thing was is that the way that I got into treatment is I was self-employed, and I had my own insurance policy, and the insurance policy I had an exclusion for addiction because it was cheaper. And when the guy said to me, well, it doesn't cover alcoholism or drug addiction because insurance companies think they're two diseases, and I said to him, so what? So I wasn't covered, right? And so I didn't have any insurance to get into a treatment center. They did this intervention. I had this house that I was living in that had been on the market for about 5 months. The treatment center that they set me up with the intervention said, you will bring a check for several thousand dollars with you on Monday when you come in, and the house sold on Friday. My share of the house, my half of the house, was $50 more than the cost of the treatment. I guess I needed to be there. So I guess the reason they kept me is I really had nowhere else to go. You know, and then they sent me to a halfway house because I had nowhere else to go, and I did that thing. And they introduced me to 12 steps, and they introduced me to 12 steps in general. And that, again, created more problems for me than it solved. I'm grateful for the fact that I was introduced to 12-step recovery. I'm not grateful for the fact that they couldn't tell me the difference. I left that treatment center and that halfway house very confused about who I was, and one more time not feeling like I belonged. They told me that the longer it took me to introduce myself in the beginning of a meeting, the more diseases that I had, the safer I was going to be, and the better my recovery would be. So I could take 5 minutes to introduce myself, because if there was a disease anyway related to addiction, I had it. And I would singly identify all of them and try to find a fellowship to deal with each of them. Obviously, I didn't make any kind of commitments early on in my recovery, and it was very costly in my recovery for me. If you have a choice today, I suggest you don't do what I did, unless you have a high pain threshold, unless you enjoy being confused, and unless you enjoy knowing you don't belong. I went to this place that was very loving and kind, because that's where my treatment center told me I had to go. Nobody ever told me that I couldn't talk about my drugs there. Nobody ever made me not to feel okay there. Deep down inside of me, I knew I didn't belong. See, I went to this treatment center that was a treatment center for recovering physicians. And I was a podiatrist. So I wasn't really a physician according to the physicians. So I almost belonged there. Yeah. And then they sent me, then this halfway house was run by the Junior League of Atlanta, which are a nice bunch of Baptist, Methodist women who are very much into ministering to you and teaching you about their understanding of a God. And I was Jewish. So one more time, I didn't feel like I belonged. Right? And then they talked about all this stuff about how important the support of your significant other was to your recovery. And my wife filed for divorce when I was in treatment. So I figured, here we go. I surely don't belong here. Yeah, and then they sent me to this place to go to meetings, and they said, when they say a specific substance, you just substitute drugs. And I said, damn, one more time, I got to change something so I can belong. What's wrong with this picture? And I'd love to tell you that I had the answer right away. But see, Narcotics Anonymous wasn't very involved in a whole lot of places in those days, and I didn't get exposed to it. And in all honesty, I was so messed up in those early days that there was nobody there to take my hand and show me the way. I was just so glad to be anywhere that I just took it. So when we were in this halfway house, we went to all kinds of meetings. I did notice that I preferred the Narcotics Anonymous meetings because the women were prettier. So that was motivation for me, and I believe that today. I believe Narcotics Anonymous has the prettiest women in the world. And believe me, I really have checked that out. I mean, it's something I do regularly. I got out of this treatment center, and in addition to the confusion about not having an identity, I really thought that I had learned so much that I didn't have to go to meetings. Now, I know that they told me to. They told everybody, 90 meetings in 90 days, get a sponsor, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I said, yeah, those people really need meetings. And for the first year or so, I very rarely went to meetings. And nothing changed. What a surprise. I was still as scared as I'd ever been. I was still as miserable as I'd ever been. I still had all of those same terrible feelings that I had while I was using and before I started to use. The difference was is that they felt worse than ever before. And I never thought that going to a meeting would change that. I would talk to the people that I'd been in the halfway house with, and they'd say to me, how many meetings are you going to? And I'd mumble something or other. And when they got real insistent about it, I'd go to a meeting. But I'd get there 10 minutes late. I'd sit right next to the door. When it looked like the meeting was ready to close and circle up, I'd leave, and I'd say, geez, I'm not getting anything out of these meetings at all. It's when I learned that you get out of your recovery what you put into it. And I wasn't willing to put anything into my recovery at that point. I still thought that I would be okay, that I would never have to use again based on all that learning and information they'd given me in this treatment center. That since I now understood my disease, I would never have to worry about it again. I was one of the fortunate ones with that attitude. I didn't have to go back out. My pain threshold was not as high as I thought it was, and eventually I broke down and started to go to meetings. I couldn't take the pain anymore. And I started to go, I never went to 90 meetings in 90 days. Then. I've done it many times since then, because there's many times where I've been more screwed up since then than I was when I was a newcomer. But I didn't do it then right away, and I wasn't willing to admit that maybe I was wrong right away so I could jump right into 90 and 90. No, I had to go to 2 a week and then maybe 3 a week, And then they started to ask me again, well, how many meetings do you go to? Well, I'm going to 3 a week. And I really started to develop a very small support group. And then they said to me, well, you need to get a sponsor. I said, geez, what do these people want from me? I'm going to meetings. I got to get somebody else to tell me what to do. Don't they know who I am? I had one of these really dangerous things. I had some education. I had some intelligence. And put that all together with the understanding that the treatment center gave me of the disease of addiction, I was in big trouble. And so they told me I had to get a sponsor. I went to these meetings, and I went to a speaker meeting one night, and this guy was up at this meeting, and he was talking about how he was a traveling salesman who didn't have a home phone, and he had about 3 or 4 or 5 years of recovery, and at the end of the meeting, I asked him to sponsor me. Hey, he said yes. If he's here today, I owe him amends. I have no idea what his name is. I've never seen him again. I wouldn't know him if he walked up to me, but I had a sponsor. And that let me continue to do it my way for a whole lot longer. Finally, with about 12, 13 months clean, I had to move from the town that I was living in at that point and move down to Orlando where I live now. And this little, all of a sudden, this town that I had hated since I'd been there coming out of the halfway house, I didn't want to leave it. Sounded real familiar to me. Change was not something I was good at. I was really afraid to leave, and this sort of support group that I had almost allowed to be there said to me, well, you need to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, you need to get a sponsor, you need to get really involved, tra-la-la, same old stuff. So I moved to Orlando and didn't go to a meeting for 90 days. I was going to do it my way one more time, and I hated Orlando, I hated my partner, I hated my job, I hated everything, and I figured it was all Orlando's fault. I never looked at the fact that I wasn't doing anything. I finally got to the point where, and I believe all of us have this point inside of us, where deep down inside we know that we know that we know that we better damn well do something, we're in big trouble. And I had this gnawing in my gut that said to me, you're ready to go out the door, son. Something better change in your life now. And my pride and my ego played with that gnawing for an awful long time until the pain got so bad that I finally copped out and went to a meeting. And there weren't any Narcotics Anonymous meetings in Orlando at that time, which had been my excuse for not going to any meetings. Of course, I hadn't committed to Narcotics Anonymous at that point anyhow, but it was any excuse would do not to going to meetings. So I used that excuse not to go. There weren't any NA meetings in town. I went to a young people's meeting of another fellowship. There were 10 or 12 people in there, And I walked in there, looked around, said, this will do, sat down and proceeded to teach these people about the disease as I understood it from all of my phenomenal knowledge, and gave my phone number to all the women in the room so I could develop a support system, and left this meeting. My phone rang the next day, and fortunately, one of those women in that room were recovering enough to give my phone number to one of the guys. And I guess the other six were recovering enough not to call me, so it worked out fine. God really gave me what I need that first year in Orlando, I'm here to tell you. Certainly not what I wanted. This guy called me and he said, I'm sure you don't know who I am. I was the guy sitting next to you in the meeting, but you didn't pay any attention to any of us. And he said to me, you're new in town, Charlie, all this stuff, you want to go to lunch. And I was so lonely at that point in my life, I'd have gone anywhere. You know, so I went to lunch with this guy, and we went to dinner together, and we started to go to meetings. And from going to no meetings a week, I was going to 9 meetings a week. And we didn't know anything at all about traditions in those days or about any of that stuff. And we did finally find this thing that was called a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And it was really like, when I called and asked about Narcotics Anonymous, the reason I ended up at that young people's meeting was they told me to go to that meeting and sit there and somebody would contact me. It was like it was a secret society in those days. You know? And so there was this meeting that was being held in an adolescent treatment center, and I guess you had to have some way of getting there. You had to know some way to get in there. But this guy knew that way to get in there, and we went to that meeting. And the meeting was filled with people in treatment, young people in treatment who didn't want to be there, didn't want to be in treatment, and didn't want to be at the meeting, and 2 counselors. One of whom thought it was okay for her to drink because she was just an addict. And the other one who really understood this deal but couldn't keep a needle out of his arm for more than 2 weeks. He just couldn't do it. Right. And in spite of that, in spite of all of that stuff, what happened to that meeting was enough that this guy and I and one other guy we took with us are still all clean today. And then Narcotics Anonymous came out of that. And it taught me something that I said earlier tonight, teasing somebody who was sitting behind me, but it taught me something that was a real valuable lesson to me. And that's so that I needed to judge the message and not judge the messenger. Because even though they couldn't get the message themselves, the message they gave was the right message. And because it didn't work for them, rather than worry about the fact that they weren't walking it, I needed to listen to the fact that they were doing the best they could and they were saying something that I needed to hear. And I know for me that I'm real quick to get out of myself, judge other people, and invalidate anything they have to say, especially if it's something I don't want to hear. And it's real important for me not to do that sometimes. I understand that people who say things to me for the most part today are not saying things to hurt me. They say things to me because they care. You know, I've never known any addict who willfully wanted to hurt another addict in these rooms. I'm not saying we don't do each other great harm. I'm saying that our motives are not to hurt each other. And if I understand that, then I can be a little bit more open to receiving what it is you have to say, and I try not to judge you as much. What happened from that point was that the 3 of us started Narcotics Anonymous meetings, and we really had no idea what we were doing. We were the group conscience of Narcotics Anonymous in the Orlando area, without any question. The 3 of us were group conscience. We started meetings based on the fact that if we got a phone call that there was a facility to get available, whoever got the phone call said yes and then decided there was going to be a meeting there that night. And then he'd call the other 2 of us and say, we now have a meeting on Wednesday night, and it's over here, and we'll meet at coffee and decide what to call it and what the format of the meeting should be. And that's what we did, and we printed up these meeting lists, we typed it out, and we Xeroxed them, and we left them on the tables, and surprisingly enough, very few people came to the meetings, and even fewer people stayed. Because we were so incestuous, the 3 of us, that we really didn't know how to open our arms or our hearts to the newcomer. We didn't know how to get out of ourselves enough to let people know that there was a place for them in those rooms, and they came in and felt like it was a closed club. And we didn't understand that at that time. We couldn't even see it. We went to something called a regional service committee meeting, because we heard that there were other addicts going to be close by. We didn't even know there was Narcotics Anonymous anywhere else in Florida. We thought we were unique. Narcotics Anonymous was about a year and a half, 2 years old at that point, and had already had a world convention and was forming a region. And we went to the second meeting of the Florida region of Narcotics Anonymous, and the three of us walked in there and said, "We're from Orlando," and the chairperson said, "Great, who's your ASR? And this, you guys sit over there, and you're now called the Orlando area of Narcotics Anonymous." We didn't know what an area was, but we were it. Right? So we got in the circle and decided that one of us was going to be the ASR and one of us was going to be the alternate, and the third guy could be the chairperson of the area, so that there, at least everybody would have something to do, you know. And our idea of a group conscience was in a corner, 2 out of 3 wins. That was the group conscience of the area. Now, guess what, guys? Narcotics Anonymous is alive and well and living in Orlando, and the Florida region is fine, too. You know, so our best efforts to screw it up didn't work. You know, and the fact that we didn't follow the traditions and we didn't know what we were doing didn't hurt anybody but us. You know, and what I've come to understand for me today is that, yeah, the traditions protect the groups, but the guidelines and everything that we know about service today is to protect the servant much more than the fellowship. This is God's fellowship. It's going to be fine. I'm the one that's got a problem. You know, and if I don't listen to what the people who went before me teach me, then I can get hurt. And how badly I get hurt will determine whether I tuck my tail between my legs and run to another fellowship or run somewhere else and leave the only place that I belong, whether I'll go out the door and use, or whether I can suck it up and work these steps and stay here. And I don't know. Something real sad happened to that triumvirate. The three of us have gone our separate ways, or the two of them went in one direction and I went to another. Something happened to me with about that much clean time where I finally began to understand something called the traditions. I hadn't worked the steps yet, but I did understand the traditions. Now, given who I was, that was a dangerous combination. I had a good book knowledge, a great understanding of parliamentary procedure. I had almost become a certified parliamentarian before I got clean, right? And now I had this thing called the traditions. I was a chairperson's worst nightmare. It's why it was only fitting eventually that I should become a chairperson so I could know what people like me felt like, you know. But I used those traditions and I used that parliamentary procedure to try to get my will any way that I could. And I paid the price for it. I believe that you can have anything you want in recovery if you're willing to pick up the tab. Sometimes that tab's more than I'm willing to pay. And if I don't pick it up right away, it collects interest. And then sometimes the tab's too heavy and I can't pick it up. And that means I hit the door. So I learned early on for me to be real careful what I asked for. Because I could get it if I was willing to pay for it, some way or another. And what happened with that whole deal was that the tradition sunk in enough for me to understand that I was not comfortable except in one fellowship. That I could not continue to read these things in meetings without making a commitment. You know, unity to me meant that I had to belong to something. In order for me to belong, to be a part of, I had to commit. In order for me to commit, that meant that I couldn't bounce around. I had been riding this fence for real close to 3 years, and it got real irritating. It got real painful. It got real scary. I'm the kind of addict that will find the cracks. I'm not going to look for what's positive. I'm going to hide in all the spaces you give me to hide. And so I would share part of me in one place and part of me in some other place and part of me somewhere else, and nobody knew who I was. And when the going got tough somewhere, I'd leave there and go somewhere else. When it got time to be honest, it was time to move. And as long as I was going to meetings, I could convince myself that I was okay. And I never made that commitment. And coming up on 3 years clean, it was time. And I made that commitment, and that broke my relationship with these other two men. Because they were unwilling to make that commitment. They're unwilling to make that commitment today. They're still clean. God bless them. It still works for them. I couldn't do it anymore. I know for me today that my opinions about where you go and what you do for your recovery are that they're none of my business. They only become my business when you want to serve this fellowship. Right? I believe that if you're going to carry a message of recovery in Narcotics Anonymous, that you have to live that message. I don't believe that I can stand there and do a public information presentation about how recovery is possible from the disease of addiction in Narcotics Anonymous if I'm not recovering from the disease of addiction in Narcotics Anonymous. The choice was easy for me. Our first step is totally unique. There's nothing like it anywhere else in the world of recovery. We're the only fellowship that deals with a disease. I knew that I had a disease. I knew my disease included all substances, all relationships, and everything else I could possibly think of that was outside of me that could change the way I would feel. Gambling, money, you pick it. Anything you want to deal with. Women, I mean, yeah, I'm codependent. You know, I don't know anybody who's an addict who's not. You know, they didn't have codependency when I got clean. It was a disease I believe that they created to fill empty beds in treatment centers. That happens to be my opinion. That doesn't mean that we're not all sick when it comes to the way that we relate to other people. And it doesn't mean that we don't all need help in that area. But the help is in the first step for me and in all the steps that follow. If I accept the fact that my inability to relate honestly with another human being without trying to control and manipulate is part of my disease of addiction, and that I'm powerless over that, and that a power greater than I can help me with that, then I have a shot. If I'm not willing to do that, then I can go 6 million places and get therapized to death, and nothing's going to change. Now, and that's what I know for me. If you've done other things and it's worked for you, God bless you, and I'm real happy for you. But it doesn't work for me. I got involved in a time, and I guess I'm going to jump around, but I'm right here right now, and this is where it's at. I had a partner of mine that I had to put into treatment. And I didn't know it at the time, but when I put him into treatment, part of my responsibility for putting him into treatment was I had to go to codependency treatment for 6 days as this addict's codependent. I didn't want to go. You know, I wasn't at all open-minded at that point. So I called my sponsor and I said to him, they want me to go do this deal and I don't want to do it. And he said to me, why? And I said, because I don't believe in that stuff. He said, I don't either, but be open-minded and go for him. Unique concept. I never would have thought of doing something like that. So I went. And I went there and I spent 5 or 6 days, I don't remember, in codependency treatment. And I learned an awful lot. I learned that everything that they talked about, I could deal with in the steps of Narcotics Anonymous. And it was a real important lesson for me because it made the fact that I had made that commitment all the more clear to me. And that commitment was very, very important to me. I made that commitment, and of course, making that commitment for me, that first guy that had picked me up after that first meeting became my sponsor. And since he was no longer willing to make that commitment, things had a way of working out. About that same time, we got into some personality issues and some other things, and I did a non-searching and very fearful fourth step that consisted of about 2.5 pages that I got locked in a room to do overnight and shared all my deep, dark secrets with him, and the next couple of days he let me go as a sponsee. And of course, I took this real personally. I wasn't willing to look at the fact that I hadn't done a real fourth step, and what was I so upset about? I hadn't gotten real vulnerable with him, and he hadn't let me go because of all these deep, dark secrets that I shared with him. He let me go because it was time for us to go our separate ways. And he didn't know that, and I didn't know that, but that was the way it was. And I was really scared. I needed to get a sponsor, and I didn't know what to do. At this point, I had already started to believe in sponsorship. See, this first sponsor and I was exactly the kind of sponsor I wanted anyhow. He hadn't worked the steps. I hadn't worked the steps. He didn't have a whole lot more clean time than I did. If I called him up to see if I could do something, not only would he co-sign it, he'd usually want to participate. You know, so I had a free ride for that whole year that I had him as a sponsor, and it kept getting me sicker. And so I now had to find another sponsor. And I looked around the Orlando area, and there was nobody going to Narcotics Anonymous meetings that had more clean time than I did, except for one other guy who had been my sponsor's sponsor. But he wasn't only going to Narcotics Anonymous, but I justified that at that point. I compromised my principles. And that's something I learned I don't have to do today in my recovery. But I learned it by doing it. And I compromised my principles and I asked him to sponsor me. And what happened was, he started to tell me to do things I wasn't willing to do. He told me I had to go to meetings in other places because they had long-term sobriety. And that I had to get that long-term sobriety and bring it back to Narcotics Anonymous because Narcotics Anonymous desperately needed it. And it didn't wash with me. Firstly, I know that I don't catch recovery by sitting next to somebody who has it. You know? So I couldn't go to this other place and sit next to these people who spilled more than I ever drank, you know, and get anything out of that, you know, and that was for me. The other reason was is I didn't really think that anything had to be brought back to Narcotics Anonymous other than the steps. You know, there were people there now in Orlando that had 2 and 3 years clean. And yeah, we weren't dinosaurs, but we were doing the best we could. And we sure starting to talk about the steps. And we had gotten a book that year, and there was stuff in that book. And we didn't have to do it alone. And we weren't just dealing with a couple of pieces of literature anymore. We had people who were sharing their experience, strength, and hope for us through writing. And that worked for us. And there were addicts all over the Florida region that had more time, that were willing to drive 6 and 7 hours to come to Orlando to help us with a meeting. And they kept telling us that anytime we asked. So we didn't need to go anywhere else. And so I stopped listening to that sponsor except when he told me what I wanted to hear. You know, and one more time, I knew that it was time for a change. And during that time, I went to a world convention in New York. You see, at this point, I was already chairman of the Florida region, and I had done some other things, and I figured I had 3 years clean, and I was chairman of the Florida region. It was time for me to have a relationship. You know, I was due. I mean, I would sit there and tell you that God did not get me clean to spend the rest of my life alone. And I really believed that at that point. I also believed all of the other insanity that society teaches us and we bring into these rooms. I believed that I wasn't okay unless I was in a relationship. I believed that in order to be whole, I had to have a woman on my arm. I believe in order to be a success, that you had to really envy what I walked in the room with. I believe that my well-being was judged by how you judged me by who I was with. And most of all, I thought that the worst thing in the world was to be alone. And I needed a fix. And I wasn't willing to cop to that, but that was reality. I needed a fix. And I believe for this addict and many others that I know, that when we stopped using drugs, our drug of choice was sex. And in order not to be considered a slut, I needed to have a committed relationship. So I went to the World Convention in search of. And it certainly wasn't recovery that I went up there after. And it wasn't recovery that I got. I got exactly what I was looking for. I held my arm out. She fit right underneath it. I know why I held my arm out. God knows why she went underneath it. That's her story. Yeah. She was everything I ever wanted in a woman. She was. I mean, that was the sad part. She really, really was. Yeah. It's funny now because it's been a long time. But at that point in time, if I'd have prayed to God to give me exactly what I wanted, that's what he would have given me. She was 5'4", blue-eyed, blonde, beautiful. She had 2 years clean. I had 3. It sounded right to me, you know. She was committed to Narcotics Anonymous, and tra-la-la. I mean, you know, we looked in each other's eyes, and the bells tolled, you know, and it was magic. And, of course, it was a world convention in New York, and it was so romantic. We went on the back of the Staten Island Ferry on that tail portion of the boat back there, and it was like a midnight cruise on a Saturday past the Statue of Liberty, and all these addicts are on this boat singing God Bless America as we're going past the Statue of Liberty. And there's fireworks in the harbor, and we're locked in each other's eyes, and what else? You know, movies are made like that. You know, it was absolute love, you know. And it was. It was phenomenal. I'm here to tell you that what happened was that it went very quickly from lust to something that I know today is called limerence, which is the spot between lust and commitment. You go, it's not lustful anymore. It's now a meaningful relationship, but not quite meaningful enough for me to work the steps yet. You know, and that was the whole deal. You know, I believe for me that God gives me opportunities. And if I don't take advantage of those opportunities, I pay the price for blowing it, and I'll get another opportunity down the road. And I believe that was an opportunity for me, and I hadn't done what I had to do to be ready for it. I hadn't worked the steps. I hadn't done anything to change who I was. I hadn't done anything to have a real conscious contact with a God in my life. What prayer did I have of bringing God into that relationship? And without God in that relationship, what prayer did that relationship have? But I thought it was wonderful. And I would sit there and go to places and share. And I would sit there and tell you how God was in heaven, how everything was wonderful with the world, how recovery has been very, very good to me. I want for nothing in the whole world. And I believed it. And I still hadn't worked a step. You know, sad but true. Now, if you think you can stay clean, you can't stay clean without working the steps, bet me. Don't work the steps unless you can't take the pain. Yeah. I heard a speaker in Chicago who spoke many years ago, and what he kept saying was, don't work the steps if you can stand it. I thought that was real cute until I realized he was talking to me. Yeah. I had a very, very, very high pain threshold. I also had a very, very active imagination that could keep me going lots of different directions and keep me unfocused so that I didn't feel anything because I was too scattered. And I also had this ability to live in illusion. You know, I had no concept of reality at all. And the best example I can tell you is that for me, this woman was the perfect woman. And when our relationship ended, we had gotten very, very close to a lot of people in the Florida region. And I got to see her shortly after the relationship ended in a service meeting because she had gotten involved in service because I was involved in service. And she was an active service participant, and she was being real arrogant and real asinine in a service meeting. And I turned to these other people. I'll wait. You can hear that click a mile away. I turned to these other people in that room that were friends of mine, and I said, my God, she's changed an awful lot since we're not together anymore. And they looked at me and said, no, she hasn't. And I said, excuse me? And she said, she's always been that way. You just never saw it. And that let me know how deep an illusion that I lived in. See, if you don't fit through the mold, I'm going to push you through the mold, and you're going to come out looking like you fit through that mold on the other side. Right? Because that's the way that my mind worked. What happened to that situation was that we did the best we could. And in the beginning, it was real, real beautiful. And when we walked into a room, people felt better because we were so happy. And we looked lovingly and caringly at each other, and we thought this was going to go on forever. And it didn't. The relationship got into big trouble. At this point in time, just before I got married to this woman, and I did marry her, because I wasn't a slut, see, I don't know what happened to this whole deal. I mean, I met her in September. She moved in by the end of September. By October 1st, she was wearing an engagement ring, and I never remembered asking her. But I was okay with it. I mean, I knew I bought the ring, you know. And it was real okay with me, I wanted nothing more than to marry this woman and live happily ever after. And that was exactly the point. I wanted nothing more. And I learned something when I first got clean that was real, real important that I didn't want to remember. Anything that I put before my recovery, I will lose. Anything. And she was more important to me than my recovery. And God loved me enough to take her away, because if he hadn't, I'd be using today. Because anything I put before that recovery of mine, I will lose. And if I'm not real fortunate, I'll lose my recovery right behind it. And I had done that in other areas, but not in an area so important. See, I cut this deal with God. God, you can have anything you want from me, just don't take my wife. And God said, no deal. You know, it was real simple. You know, before I got married, I had to find a sponsor. And I guess what'll clear it up is I got back from New York, and I met this woman, and I said to the guy that was sponsoring me, who I wasn't listening to anyhow, I met this woman in New York, and we're going to get married, and what do you think? You know, at least I asked him what he thought. That was unique for me anyhow. And he said to me, well, don't you think you ought to slow it down a little bit and take your time, maybe make a pro and con list and look at all these other things and everything else? And my open-mindedness at that point was, look, just because you've been dicking around in this relationship that you're in for 11 months and you're unwilling to make a commitment, don't lay your crap off on me. You know, I'm not willing to get hooked up on your fears. You know? I know what I'm doing, right? Right. So, what could he say? I mean, at that point, he didn't have any input because none was being taken. And he shared with me later on, because when we finally went our separate ways, we did talk, you know, and that was different for me. And he said to me, you are one of the most interesting people I've ever tried to sponsor. And I noticed the tried, because he never sponsored me. I never allowed that. And he said to me, you never came to me for help. He said, you came to me to tell me what was wrong in your life and what solution you had found, and then ask me what I thought of the solution. And my attitude was like this, you know, look, I'm real squirrely, and I'm blah, 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 blah. I think what's wrong is I haven't been praying enough, and I need to pray more often, meditate more often, and go to 90 meetings in 90 days. What do you think? How's he going to say no? I mean, you know, how can you say that can't work? Everybody knows that'll work. You know, what choices did I give him? You know, so he never really had a chance to share with me anything at all. I don't know whether the man has any recovery or not. I never was open to it. And that's not his fault. But I knew that there was something wrong there, and so I started to pray. God help me, God help me, God help me. What am I going to do about this sponsorship situation? And he moved to Arizona. Like within a month of the time I started to pray, he got a job offer in Arizona, took it and left. And I was like, boy, I'm glad I didn't have to do anything with that. I didn't make that decision either. And I had to find a sponsor. And I looked at all the people that he was sponsoring and saw what they did. And they all went to this one guy, and he was recovering in another fellowship. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I couldn't, in my own recovery, endorse an outside enterprise and be okay with it. I couldn't one more time tell you that you can recover in Narcotics Anonymous, but I have to go somewhere else to learn how to work the steps. I couldn't believe that. So I started to look around, and I looked around, and I looked around, and I had this woman in Miami who was a very, very dear friend of mine who made me feel a part of in Narcotics Anonymous when I first got to that first service meeting. Because people who know me now can possibly maybe not believe the fact that I stood at the door of that first service meeting in a corner and would not move and was petrified and would not say a word to anybody about anything. And this woman saw this, and she came up to me, and she put her arm around my shoulder, and she said, we don't bite. You're welcome here. Come on in and sit down. And she sat me down with a bunch of people who were sitting in a circle talking, and I just sat there and shook, and she held me. And it was wonderful. You know, and it was one of these things is she just recently got married in Miami, and she was a woman that was a lot of inspiration for me. She was very involved in service. She had been chair of the World Service Conference and then done lots of other things. And she had told me from the beginning that if you work the steps on a day-to-day basis, that she knew for her, she was on a collision course with Mr. Wright. She just didn't know when he was going to show up. And that her job was to put one foot in front of another and to work the steps, and God would provide him to show up when she had to hit him. And she's now married, and she found exactly what she was looking for, and that gave me all the hope I really needed in this deal, because she had nothing to do with it. All she did was what she said she was going to do. And she started to talk to me about this deal of sponsorship, and she suggested this one guy who lived down in Miami. And my attitude was, him? You got to be kidding. Anybody but him. Yeah. And she said, well, what's wrong with him? Well, I proceeded to take his inventory and talk about how arrogant he was and how judgmental he was and all of these things, you know. And the other thing I said was, you know, and plus we don't agree on anything. And I got two pieces of information from that deal. One was she said to me, well, maybe that's real good to have a different point of view for a change. Look where your way has gotten you up to now. Interesting. And the other thing was I learned about me. And I learned about me later on in that deal. I did all of this judging, and she said to me, instead of judging this man, who I'd hardly ever spoken to except in a room of service, So I don't know what I based my judgment on at that point. I do know now what I based that judgment on. She said, why don't you talk to the guys he sponsors and see what kind of sponsor he is? I said, fine, who does he sponsor? She said, all the guys you hang out with at regionals. I said, oh, you know, there might be some hope there. And I did that. I talked to these guys, and they talked about a man I didn't know. And that taught me something about me and this addict. What he had that I wanted was respect. He had respect to the people in the region. He had a way about him that let me know deep down inside that he knew what he was about, that he had the steps in his life, that he had a God, and that he could hold up his head high and take a seat in the room because he knew he belonged there. He was committed to this fellowship, and he was doing service to this fellowship, and he had the utmost respect everywhere he went. And for me, this addict, the easiest way for me to deal with somebody who was what I wanted to be was to try to destroy them rather than try to get to be who they were by doing what they did. And that's what my inventory was. It let me know that the best way for me to feel equal for you is to bring you down, not try to stand up. And I had to be real aware that that's the way that I used to behave. And that's one of the gifts that's come to me from the steps. And I asked this man to sponsor me at a service meeting, of course. And he didn't say yes right away. How dare he, you know? What he said is, I'm going to go outside. I'll be right back. Let me think about it. And I know today that he was as astonished that I asked as I was at asking him. I later had to share with him how desperate I was, and he said he had sensed the desperation, you know. and I know that he went outside to pray, you know. Like, God, what are you doing to me, you know. And he came back and he said to me, yes, but you have to remember one thing. You asked me. I didn't ask you. So we're going to do this deal my way. And I was like, oh. And then he told me three other things. He said to me, don't ever lie to me and call me once a week. And then he said, I know you're judging yourself now because you've never worked the steps, and I know you're really down on yourself for all this stuff, but understand you stayed clean for over 3 years, so you had to be doing something right. So put down the bat, and let's get on with the steps. And I needed that at that point, and I've come to understand that this man is probably the most gentle man I ever knew. Oh, shit, all the time. I never can share about him without filling up, and that's a gift. He's obviously saved my life more than once, but he taught me something. He taught me about love. I came here not believing I was capable of loving myself or anybody else. And through the way that he loved me, he showed me that not only was I worthy of love, but that I knew how to love back. And I know how to love this man without conditions and without possession. I'm not jealous of the other people he sponsors. I'm not jealous of his time. I don't get all bent out of shape if he forgets to do something that's important to me. I have no problem with him being human. I have no problem with him making mistakes. I have no problem with him being an addict. I have no problem with anything that he does, because I know deep down inside that he loves me, and I know deep down inside that I love him. And I know that if I could ever have a relationship with a woman like that, that it would work. Yeah. What happens to me is that if a woman I'm in a relationship with forgets something, it's like the end of the world. You forgot my anniversary. You forgot my birthday. You could do this to me. You know, all of a sudden, it's a big deal. You know, with a woman, there's pride and ego. With this man, there is none of that anymore. He's seen me at my worst, and he's been there. And I've seen him at his worst, and I didn't judge him for it. And I don't know how that happened, but I know that it happened. And I know because that happened, I was willing to work the steps. And he gave me an assignment about writing the first three steps, and I wasn't willing right away. I mean, he told me that at the first time that we started this deal, and he said, write the first three steps and put them in the mail to me, and then we'll go on from there. And he told me how he wanted the first three steps written. And I'm not into telling you how I write the steps. I believe that that's between you and your sponsor. You know, I know that there are different ways of doing it, and if it works for you, do it. If it doesn't, you'll know. You know, but I don't believe you can work the steps without writing them. I mean, that's my opinion, and it's been my experience. So he told me to write the first three steps and to send them to him, and my first reaction to him was, well, yeah, but I got 3.5 years clean, and I'm chairman of the region, and I've already gone over the first three steps with my other sponsors, and can't we start on the fourth step? You know, right after he told me we were going to do it his way, you know. And he said to me, write the first three steps and put them in the mail to me and call me on Monday. And I said, okay. Yeah, I realized I wasn't getting anywhere. And of course, I didn't write the steps because now I had a sponsor and I could take a breath, you know, and it wasn't crisis anymore and everything was okay. And so I took a breath and I celebrated the fact that I had a sponsor and I took a vacation and didn't do anything until something happened. Now, I know that a lot of people do foxhole praying. I do foxhole step work. I work the steps when I'm ready to lose something. You know, I cut this deal with God. God, I'll work these steps. Don't take it away. And so I was going to get on a plane and go see a lawyer because the little bit that I had left at that point in my recovery was being threatened with some kind of lawsuit. So I furiously sat down and wrote these three steps. And I made this deal with God. God, I'll have the three steps done before I leave the airport where I'm going. Don't take anything away from me. And I wrote them on the plane and into the taxi, into the airport, and finished them up and sealed them and put them in the envelope and dropped them in the mailbox in the airport so God knew I was serious. You know, and he wasn't going to take anything away from me. And I went to the lawyer's office and nothing happened. You know, there was no big deal. I had projected all kinds of gloom and doom and fear that was totally unrealistic anyhow. And even if I hadn't written those three steps, probably nothing would have happened. But, you know, I wanted to believe at that point, yeah, God, we got some deal going here, you know. I'll keep doing it this way and you keep your end of the bargain up. We're going to be fine. And I knew that my sponsor was being sponsored by somebody out of town, so I knew he knew how to do this deal. And I called him up about, five or six days later, and I said, did you get the steps? He said, yeah. And I couldn't say to him, well, what did you think? Because my pride was too bad. You know, I couldn't say to him, what did you think of those steps? Or how were they? Do you have anything to say about them? I wasn't willing to be humble enough to ask. And he never said anything. You know, he just said, this is what I want you to write on your fourth step. And it took me about a year and a half to ask him about those three steps, you know. And I said, by the way, what did you think of the first three steps? You know, this is after I had a real solid relationship with him. And he cracked up and he said to me, I put you on the fourth step, didn't I? What else do you need to know? You know, too simple. I could have never thought of that, especially dealing in pride, you know. And so he had me write this fourth step. And he had me write this real long, involved fourth step because I had never been fearless and thorough. And so I had to write everything I could think and feel. And it was a really long deal. And I was about, 42, 43 at the time. I don't even remember. And, of course, I didn't write it right away, but something was going on in my life. And you get to a point, I believe, in recovery where you know that you know that you know, but you won't cop to it. You know, and I knew that I knew that I knew that my relationship was in big trouble. But I stayed in denial for as long as I could. And deep down inside, I knew it was in big trouble, so I cut another deal with God. God, I'll finish the fourth step. Don't take her away, you know. And I sat down and became totally obsessed with this fourth step. I barely went to any meetings. All I did was sit and write. I didn't go out anywhere. I didn't do anything. I went to work, came home, and wrote. And I wrote a fourth step that was well over 200 pages. And that's not to tell you that I'm you know, thorough or fearless. It's just to show you how sick I am. You know, I went down to Miami, and I worked the fourth step with the fourth step with my sponsor. And the way that my sponsor does a fourth step with the people he sponsors, and that's the way I do it now, too, is he sits there with a pad of paper, and he makes notes. And I had to sit there and read all of this stuff. It took 5-6 hours. I don't really know. But I did learn something right then. Out of those 200 and something pages, this thing that was so important to me in my life, this relationship, this only thing that mattered to me, didn't take 2 pages. Talk about denial. Talk about not being willing to look at what's really going on. And my sponsor had me read these whole bunch of pages, and he reduced everything I wrote to one half of one piece of paper, right? No patterns in my life, no repeated insanity, no habits, you know. Right? 200 pages of saying, see above, see above, see above, see above. You know? And, my fantasy was is that I'd finish the fourth step, that my sponsor would sit down with her sponsor, and the four of us would work this whole deal out, and we'd all live happily ever after. And one more time, my concept of reality was nowhere close. I knew at that convention that I went to, it was a Florida regional convention right after I finished that step, that my marriage was over. I wasn't willing to admit it, and it took another 2 months for it to end. And it ended at a world convention in Washington, D.C., which was real poetic. I mean, full circle. Started in a world, ended in a world. I didn't think it was very poetic at the time. I didn't think it was real funny. I didn't think of anything other. I didn't think. I was in such excruciating pain that I couldn't feel anything but that pain. I would love to tell you that it was okay, but there was really nothing okay. The marriage was over. The way that it ended was ugly, and a lot of people got hurt by the ugliness. She had, I believe also that paybacks are a bitch, but I'll get mine someday, and the first two marriages that I had been in while I was using, I didn't know what fidelity meant, and the third one was my payback. Right? And it was sloppy, and it was careless, and it was obvious, and my pride and ego were right out there on the line, you know, and it, my attitude was, how could she do this to me and with him? And it was, you know, all of that stuff, the really sad part of it was is that an awful lot of people who cared about him, who cared about her, and who cared about me got hurt in the process. And I've come to understand today that we're not real good at doing those things neatly. You know, we're not real good at that at all. She did the best she could. You know, it wasn't good enough, but it was the best she could. And how can I blame him, who was supposed to be my friend, for being obsessed with her when I was just as obsessed with her as he was? You know, I blamed them for a long time, but I can understand now what they went through. Yeah. You know, unfortunately, they never forgave themselves, and both of them are using today. And that's the real catastrophe. They've been using, she had 6 years, he had 5 years when they went out, and they've been out for a couple of years. And I try to be a good recovering addict and remember them in my prayers, and I don't always do that, but when I think about it, I do, and it's probably the hardest thing for me to deal with out of that whole deal. It took me about a year to be able to hug them in meetings, and then they were gone. And it was like I had finally gotten over the fact that it was over, and then I had to get over the fact that people I really cared about were using. And those of you who have a problem with staying clean, if you think when you go out the door that all you hurt is yourself, look around the rooms. Because every time one of y'all go out there, you take a piece of us with you. You know, and we're real glad that you bring that piece back when you come back, but not all of you make it back. And I don't know whether they're going to make it back or not, and I pray that they do. A lot of other people use behind that, too. I sponsored most of the men in Orlando at that time. She sponsored most of the women. And people got real caught up in this insanity, took sides, got crazy, and didn't know what to do. And it was real, real sad. The beauty of it was that I learned about the therapeutic value of one addict to another. The man at the World Convention saved my life. I was finally well enough to let the men do it. I got there and I couldn't put one foot in front of the other with 5 years clean. I didn't know who I was, where I was going, or what was going on. I did a workshop. I did a four-step workshop at the World Convention. No mistakes in this world. And I don't remember any of it. You know, I had set the whole deal up so that other people would do it for me, and they all backed out and left me sitting there alone to do it. And that's all I remember about it. I heard the tape, and it was pretty good. And that's one of the few tapes of mine that I listened to because I wasn't there. You know, I mean, I was, people come up to me and say, I saw you in D.C., and I go, you know, I don't remember. I know that my attitude was real sick. You know, they promised me if I didn't get humble, I'd get humiliated, and I was totally humiliated in D.C., and I had nothing to be humiliated about. Right? But I was sure that you judged me as being inadequate because my wife had left me for another man, because that's how I judged me. And nobody judged me at all but me. You know, and nobody judged her either. You know, that was really one of the nice things. And the women really did reach out to her. And it was nice for me to see that. And it restored my faith in this program. Because just because she might have been the one doing it didn't mean that she wasn't in pain too. We don't do things like that unless we're hurting. You know, we don't do things like that unless we're desperate. That's not the kind of people we are when we get in these rooms. And so the men reached out for me and they took me everywhere I needed to go. They took me to meetings. They put me to bed at night. They woke me up in the morning. There was one guy that was my grand sponsor that literally shoved food in my face and pushed my jaw up and down until I would chew by myself because I was unwilling to eat. And if you know this guy, he's big and he's got big forearms. And, you know, it was easier to eat than to fight with him. And I really understood how men can love men now. You know, I really could see in all of the eyes of the men that some of whom I never saw before, that all they cared about was an addict who was in pain, and all they wanted was for me to stay clean one more hour and stop hurting as quick as I could. And that was all that they wanted from me. And they were everywhere. They offered to take me home with them when the convention was over. They offered to come home with me so I didn't have to be alone. They offered to do anything that they had to do. Some guy even asked me to sponsor him in the middle of all of this stuff. I mean, I was walking around like a vegetable, and he came up and he said, "I really love what you're doing, can you sponsor?" I looked at this guy and I said, "You want to be like this in 5 years?" And he said to me, "But I respect your honesty." I said, "I don't have a choice. You know, this is not something I'm volunteering right now." But I did sponsor the guy for a while, and it worked out fairly well. They put me on a plane, and I went home, and my wife went her separate way, and I went back to the house that we had lived in. And the guys in the program picked me up at the airport. And I learned another very valuable lesson then. I learned about the two-way street of sponsorship, because the guys that I sponsored saved my life. You know, they didn't have as much clean time as I did, and they had no idea what I was going through. But they knew they loved me, and they were there. And they did what they had to do. They did the same thing. They put me to bed at night. They woke me up in the mornings. They sent me to work. They did whatever they needed to do. There was always an addict staying in my house. Usually there were 20 or 30 of them in the living room. I'd get up in the morning, go to work, and step over people I didn't even know. And it was great. Yeah, and you tell me that we don't come together when there's a crisis. And you tell me we don't know how to take care of ourselves and each other. That's not been my experience. And sooner or later, things had to happen. I had to get on with my life, and it took a while. You know, and I kept calling my sponsor every day, and I'd say to him, "When does the pain go away?" And he said, "When it goes away." You know, and I said, "Well, how much is it normal for me to feel this way?" And he said, "Yes." And now all I needed to know is it was okay to feel that way. And I had gotten to the point that when the pain finally did go away, I didn't even know it was gone until I realized I missed it. You know, it was like, "What's wrong? I'm not crazy today." You know, it's like, I know that for me there's a tremendous difference between being in pain and suffering. You know, I've heard people say that pain in this program is optional. I don't believe that for me. Maybe it is for other people. Suffering is optional. Self-pity is optional. Suffering addicts use. Addicts in pain work the steps. I mean, that's basically the difference. I learned a lot about not defending myself during that time. Because obviously, Narcotics Anonymous is a society, and society functions on rumors and gossip. We can't help it. It's part of the human condition. You know, and I hear people getting all bent out of shape because there's gossip going on. If we're breathing, we'll gossip, and it's not just addicts, it's anybody. And so I always had, all of this stuff was going on, I wanted to defend myself. I wanted to defend myself. And my sponsor taught me about holding my head up high, taking my seat in a meeting, and sharing my experience, strength, and hope about recovery from this disease through the steps. And that was all the defense that I needed. And I didn't understand. I wanted to debate, and I wanted to bring counter-offensives. You know, I wanted to get involved in the turmoil because I thrive on turmoil. You know, I love dissension. I know how to do that real well. But being serene and having faith and believing in this program and believing in what we believe in was difficult for me. But I learned. I believe that people need to be in relationships because it's the only way they're going to work the steps. You know, I don't believe anybody's going to voluntarily do it because their days are fine. I never knew any addict I knew woke up and said, "Geez, I've had a great year. I think I'll work 3 more steps this week." You know, I don't know any addicts who have everything they want who decide to work a step. You know, I know that the addicts that I sponsor, and for me personally, that I work the steps for two reasons. Either I'm in pain or I'm stagnant, and I know that it's time to move on. And I've learned enough for me to know today that if I'm stuck, the pain is not far behind, and maybe I need to move now, and maybe something will change. You know, and if not, pain's there for me. But I also learned another thing. I spent my whole life using, and the first 5 years clean, running from pain. And what I learned about that is that the faster I run, the harder it hits me when it catches up. You know, because it has to be moving faster than I am to catch me. You know, and so the faster it's moving, the harder it's going to hit. You know, and that if I turn around and willing to face what I have to face and walk through it, it's not nearly as bad as when it comes up and hits me behind the head. And that all of the fears that I had and all of the pain that I was afraid of was not nearly as bad as I thought it was going to be. And that what the men in Washington and what the steps have taught me is that if I'm willing to put one foot in front of the other and walk through it, that the freedom on the other side is beyond my wildest dreams. And it's always been that way. And if you're in the same kind of crap that I was in D.C., or if you're in any kind of place where you feel stuck, you don't need to know where you're going to end up. All you need to know is you got to move. You know, you need to put one foot in front of the other and keep going. And have faith in the fact that that hand that's being held out to you by another addict is right where you need to reach for. And you don't have to worry about what's behind them. All you have to do is reach for that hand. I spent an awful long time wanting to know where the road got before I was ready to get on it. You know, and I've learned for me today that recovery is so simple. I look at me like a vehicle, and my responsibility is to do the maintenance on that vehicle to keep it running well, and to keep that vehicle between the lines on the road. And that's all I need to do. I believe those lines are put there by the steps and the God of my understanding, and that my job is to stay between them. And it's not my responsibility to try to stand up on the seat and look over the hill to see what's on the other side. It's my responsibility to look at the road and stay between the lines. And I see this in all the areas of my life. I had a back injury about a year and a half ago, and before that time I was running on a regular basis because it's something I like to do. It made me feel good. It made me healthier. It's something I like is my health in this recovery deal. And I had to stop running for a while, and I've started to run again. And I noticed that part of traveling around the world and around this country is that Florida is flat land. I mean, we're called flatlanders by people in other places. And a lot of the places I've been recently, they have these things called hills. So it's a new phenomenon. Right? And for me, you know, I can run fairly well on flat land, but I start running up these things called hills, and it's really an interesting thing. And there's two ways for me to get to the top of the hill, depending on how much pain I want to be in. I can look at the hill before I start to go up and say, oh my God, I'll never make it to the top, and then struggle, looking up all the way to see how close I'm getting to the top. Or I can put one foot in front of the other and run up the hill and then look over my shoulder to see what I just came up. And the second way works. I got on with the fifth and sixth step relatively quickly after that fourth step because nothing like pain to get you to work. And I saw that the exact nature of my wrongs when I wrote them on paper were all based on fear and pride. You know, and that my attitude was to get you before you got me because I was afraid. And that my attitude was to look good at all costs no matter what it did to you. And that was the exact nature of my wrongs in any situation. You know. And I learned from that fourth and fifth step a much cleaner definition of a second step for me. See, my second step definition initially was the one I hear a lot of, you know, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. That's really true. That's part of my insanity definition. But the other part of my definition of insanity is doing the same thing differently, believing I'm doing something different. And I do that on an ongoing basis. You know, that's part of the illusion that I live in. And it's part of the fact that only the steps and a God of my understanding can change that. I'm not capable of that. The sixth step was a really important step for me. It was a turning point in my recovery. It gave me an opportunity to understand what made Biff run. And I ran on character defects because I was afraid. And all of them were based on that fear in one way or another. And I was told to pray that my defects be revealed to me. And one more time, be careful what you ask for. Because they were ugly and scary and painful. And the way that I became entirely willing was that I could no longer take the pain of living in that defect. That was the only way that I could become willing. And I understood that my job finally in the sixth step was not to remove that defect of character, but was to become willing to have God do it. See, for years I worked on my sixth step. I'm working on my character defects. What am I trying to do? Get them to be better defects? I mean, it's not my job to work on the defects. It's my job to become willing to let God remove them. You know, it's my job to let God remove those shortcomings in the seventh step, not to remove them myself. And for years I tried to stop doing the things that were my shortcomings. I'm going to control my recovery. Now, where's the humility in me doing it? The humility in the seventh step for me, the humanness in the seventh step, was knowing what I had to do and not being able to do it. Was absolutely seeing on paper what had to be done and knowing that I couldn't do it. And that I had to finally ask somebody else to do it for me. In this case, a God. And it was really... It gave me a sense of humor almost, to be able to stand back and laugh at myself for trying to do all this insane stuff that I couldn't do. You know, I mean, I understood in the seventh step that I was perfectly human, which made me perfectly imperfect, and that I was never going to be able to do all of this stuff, and that it was okay to do the best I could and ask God for help, and that it was okay to say, I can't do this, that that's real acceptable. The other four steps are real, real important, but I'm going to go through them real quick, because you all have been sitting for a real long time. The eighth step for me took longer than my fourth step, because I had to write down not only all the people I had harmed, but how I had harmed them. And then when I shared that with my sponsor, it took twice as long as sharing a fourth step, because he shared all of his with me. And it increased that bond. And I have a lot of guys I sponsor that say to me, I want to be as close to you as you are to your sponsor. And I said, then work the steps with me, because that's how you get close to me. That's how you know who I am, and that's how I know who you are. You don't get close to me by going to the movies or hanging out at dances. You get close to me by working the steps. You know? And that's the relationship that I have today. The ninth step for me is an ongoing thing. I believe that I will always be doing ninth step. But I know for me, I don't make an amends by saying I'm sorry and then go do the same thing again. That's not an amends. That's a cop-out. You know, that's socially acceptable. Amends mean I'm really willing to change my behavior. I do an amends by showing you that I'm different, not by telling you I'm sorry. The tenth step, go ahead, I'll take it. The tenth step for me today, I would love to tell you that I sit down and I write a journal every night, but I don't. I do an inventory every night, but I don't do a written inventory every night. And my inventory is not only done at night, I do a checklist sometimes. Running is great for me. I can do an inventory in my head while I'm running. You know, when the inventory starts to look crazy, when I'm starting to look real negative or too perfect, then it's time to write. You know, because I know for me that my inventory in my head can get out of touch with reality relatively quickly if I'm not careful. You know, when I do an inventory of myself, and I heard a speaker share this before too, that I look at myself in my mind as being 19 or 20 years old, you know, and when I put it on paper, I have to write down my birth date. It doesn't work, you know. So I can be that out of touch with reality in other areas of my life too if I keep it in my mind. And so it's real important for me to periodically write that inventory. Yeah. And when I'm wrong, to promptly admit it. This program gives me the right to be wrong, so I have no reason to be afraid to admit that I'm wrong. Y'all gave me permission to be wrong without worrying about the fact that I was not going to be welcome here. The steps and the traditions guarantee that. One of the things I see that happens in service is that the more clean time we have and the more we work the steps, the less important it is for us to be right and the more changes we can make, because we're not afraid of being wrong in service anymore. It used to be you were so afraid of being wrong, you'd go to the death before you change your mind, because you were afraid that it wasn't going to be okay. And the 10th step gives me the right to be wrong. And promptly admitting that I'm wrong doesn't mean saying I'm sorry. You know, it just means saying to you, I'm wrong. If I owe you amends on top of that, then I better have those amends acted out in behavior. The 11th step is something that I choose to keep to me, and how I seek the God of my understanding through prayer and meditation is my way of doing it. There's no right or wrong way to do it. It just has to be done. And I believe you have to do the steps in order, and I believe people who try to do an 11th step at the third step get real confused. You know, the third step says we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood Him. It doesn't say anything about praying for the knowledge of His will for us that day or the power to carry it out. And I hear people early in recovery getting hung up on a third step because they don't know God's will for them. And it's got nothing to do with the third step. You know, you made your decision to turn your will and your life over to God's care. It's none of your business anymore. That's what the third step is. It's the freedom to get on with having the courage to take a fourth step. You don't need the knowledge of God's will. You don't have to worry about whether your will is God's will in the third step. You have to understand what your will in your life is, and you begin to understand what the care of God is. The 11th step through that prayer and meditation, you begin to get an understanding of God's will for you that day and the power to carry it out. And the 12th step is to me as important as the other 11, if not more so. You know, and I believe that all of us do 12-step work on an ongoing basis, and we all do it differently. I don't believe that we should actually do real 12-step work, and I don't mean 12-step calls, but I mean certain types of service, until we have had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. You know, if I don't have that spiritual awakening, then I don't have a message. I don't have those principles yet. I'm getting them, and it takes time. But once I've had that spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I now have a message to carry to other addicts, and I now have principles to practice in all my affairs. And I can get on with that. And the 12 say, that's why most of the service commitments say that you should have a working knowledge on the steps and traditions in order to serve. I don't believe that if we haven't had a spiritual awakening, we can talk about the spiritual nature of this program with a complete understanding to people who don't understand. Right? Because we're not clear enough on it ourselves. I don't believe that we can have a real full understanding of the spiritual principles behind the traditions without a spiritual awakening. If you're like I was and tried to work the traditions before the steps, you'll pay the price that I paid, which is a lot of pain. I believe that the steps and the traditions are married and they have to be worked together. And I believe you can't have one without the other. And I believe that both of them are essential to our recovery, both as a fellowship and as individuals. And I believe that the gifts that I've been given by serving this fellowship are beyond my wildest dreams. You know, I know a lot of people are real hesitant about service. I got into service for all the wrong reasons. But I've done a lot of right things for all the wrong reasons. And if God shows up, then I end up being right anyhow. Because I change, and then the reasons change. I got into service out of pride and ego. I also wanted to be president of NA, and I wanted to be right in the middle where you wouldn't let me go away. So I figured if I got involved in service, you couldn't throw me out. And I did that. And I stayed involved for all the wrong reasons for a while, and then the pain got great enough that I finally worked the steps. You know, I had been in service 2 years before I worked the steps, and I picked up the tab. I believe service is an opportunity, not an obligation. I believe it's a privilege that you're given to serve this fellowship. For me, I've had the privilege to give back what has been freely given to me, 100-fold. And it's been a blessing everywhere I've gone. This fellowship has taken me places I never dreamed of going. It's had me meet with people that I never thought I'd ever meet. I've been outside the United States for service to Narcotics Anonymous. I've met addicts from other cultures and other worlds, and I've gotten a feeling of hope and inspiration that I never would have gotten without it. If you don't take advantage of that opportunity, I'm not worried about Narcotics Anonymous. I'm sorry for you. There will be enough people to serve. We will be okay. If you choose not to serve, it's your loss. And service doesn't mean you have to have a title, and it doesn't mean you have to carry an elected position. It means you have to be of service to the fellowship. It means you have to sponsor people. It means you have to be there. Means that somebody better be at that door for that newcomer. I go to a lot of meetings where there's lots of people who have lots of elected positions, but nobody remembers to stand up and welcome the newcomer. And that's sad. All of this stuff we do worldwide has one reason. The reason that we do all this service stuff, the reason that you get all these reams and reams of paper, the reason that all of this stuff is going on is so that when that addict out there who doesn't even know that Narcotics Anonymous exists walks through the door, somebody will be there for him. And that somebody will say, "Welcome to Narcotics Anonymous." That doesn't mean that the people who do all that service and write all those reams of purpose have, paper have no value and no purpose. And it certainly doesn't mean that we have a right to belittle our trusted servants because they choose to give themselves to us. You know, it was really hard for me to see the way we treat our trusted servants in some places. People give themselves to this fellowship and they don't do it our way and we tear them apart. And that's not what it's about. And it used to be really bad and it's not too bad anymore. And it's getting a whole lot better. And I'm real, real grateful for that. One of the things that has made me feel so good about where we're going is that I've seen that stop almost everywhere I've been. And if you want to tear somebody's head off sometime, take a deep breath and understand that he's doing the best he can. And that doesn't mean you can't confront him with love, but if you can't confront him with love, don't confront him. You know, somebody else will trust that there's another addict in the room that has more love in his heart at that minute than you can. And you can let him do it, or her. I really don't have a whole lot else to say. Well, that's not true. I could probably go for another 3 hours, but I don't want to. What I really need to tell y'all is how much I really appreciate the way you've made me feel here one more time. And the gifts that Narcotics Anonymous has given me and that they have in store for you. You know, what I know today is that I love this program more than I've ever loved anything in my life. And that if any of you who are new can begin to feel any of the feelings that I feel now, they'll only get bigger and bigger. And those of you who aren't, you know, it keeps getting better, and it keeps getting simpler, and it keeps getting, it doesn't necessarily get easier, but it does get simpler. And the feelings get bigger and bigger and bigger. Like I said, I came here, I didn't think I was going to know anybody, and I knew a lot of people. And even the people I didn't know, when I hug them today, I can feel so much more than I could ever feel when I hugged them when I first got here. And I can look in another addict's eyes today, and I can feel the love that we, us very special people, have that nobody else has. Yeah. There's something, you know, I believe that everything that God gives us is for a reason. And I believe he gave us his disease of addiction because we're the most loving people in the world. Yeah. And I know for me today that I'm grateful to have experienced the love that I've felt from everybody, everywhere I've been. And I'm grateful to have been able to give back the love that I feel for all of you.